Ukraine continues making gains on the ground as Russian forces withdraw.
We're talking about around 3,000 square kilometers of the territories. And we know that counteroffensive is going on.
So what's the biggest takeaway from this weekend's developments?
It seems to be just a complete failure of logistics, strategy, tactics on the Russian side. Everything is just falling apart. Their lines are collapsing.
And later in the program, a group of friends is using food to raise funds to help those affected by the war. Today is Monday, September 12th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Britain's defense ministry said on Monday that Russia has likely ordered the withdrawal of its troops from the entirety of the occupied Kharkiv Oblast west of the Oxil River. The defense ministry adds that Ukraine has recaptured territory at least twice the size of Greater London. Meanwhile, Igor Konashenkov, Russia's chief defense ministry spokesperson, says that Russia continues to deliver precision strikes against units and reserves of the armed forces of Ukraine in that Kharkiv region. For more on Ukraine's military counteroffensive, we're joined by Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, a lot has transpired since we last spoke on Friday. Can you kind of give us a rundown of where things stand as Ukrainians continue their counteroffensives?
For the moment, we know that 99% of the Kharkiv region has been liberated by Ukrainian forces. This includes such crucial and key cities as Balaklia, Izum, and Kupiansk. As we know, Izum was one of the main bases of the Russian forces, and this is a strategic place in terms of its location, because it's located just in the middle, at the end of the Kharkiv region, beginning of the Donetsk region. So Ukrainian forces managed to take almost the whole territory of Kharkiv region under control. We know that for the moment, in general, what was confirmed by the general staff of Ukraine, that we're talking about around 3,000 square kilometers of the territories. And we know that counteroffensive is going on. And for the moment, we don't have, confirmation of the settlements or of the amount of settlements liberated. But we know that there are more in the Kherson region. And also we know that Ukrainian forces also continue their counteroffensive actions in the Luhansk region and Donetsk region. Also, General Staff has confirmed, and also the military heads of the Kharkiv region, they have confirmed that Ukrainian forces have reached the border with Russian Federation in the Kharkiv region, not in all of the border points, but in most of them.
Anna, you mentioned that Ukrainian forces have re-entered Izum. Can you kind of share and paint a picture of how important that is?
Well, the city of Izum is the city of 45,000 citizens, and this is, of course, and this city was under occupation for 6 months. This is extremely important point if we look at them, if we look at the front line, and if we look at the potential counteroffensive and advance of the Ukrainian forces to Donetsk region, because also for the Russian forces, this is an important city to support their actions in the Donetsk region as well. And as Institute for the Study of War mentioned in their latest report, the loss of Izum for Russian forces would mean a huge problem in terms of their advance in the Donetsk region. So we, of course, understand that now Ukrainian forces will try to make sure that protection of the city and the whole territory that was liberated as of now will be the main task for the Ukrainian forces. But the city of Izum is definitely a huge victory of the past days. We also today we received information from the officials of the Izum city that as of now, It was confirmed that at least 1,000 civilians have been killed in the city during Russian occupation. And this was due to the fact that, due to the shelling, of course, and also additionally due to the fact that all hospitals have been destroyed in the city.
Russia says that they are continuing to fire on Ukrainian positions in the Kharkiv area. But I was wondering if you could take a moment and kind of explain what has been the Russian response so far, since we have had those reports of the Ukrainian power structures and other civilian infrastructure facilities being struck over the weekend.
You're absolutely right. A Russian response yesterday in the evening was as following. The city of Kharkiv was under very bad shelling, and the main target was energy grid infrastructure. We know that two missiles reached one of the biggest energy stations in the area, and in particularly in the city of Kharkiv. This resulted in the blackout, the electricity blackout in such regions as Kharkiv, Sumy, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk, and partly Donetsk. In a couple of hours, all areas were back with electricity except of Kharkiv. The Kharkiv region for the moment has 80% of the power back, but rescue operation and repairing operation is still going on. And the city of Kharkiv is under very heavy shelling the whole day today. We're hearing report and getting reports from the city officials and from the military officials that the city of Kharkiv is suffering very bad missile attacks, and in particularly all those attacks are targeting the biggest civilian areas and civilian neighborhoods. And for the moment, we know that at least 3 people have been killed.
And speaking of power, we also heard from IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi this morning that apparently the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant is in the process of shutting down its 6th nuclear reactor. What do we know about what's going on at the plant?
It was a measure that was taken for the security reasons, first of all. We hear from Mr. Grossi that, and we know that the briefing of the meeting of the IAEA is going on, and we know that he confirmed that Ukrainian question and particularly the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant question would be one of the main to discuss. And we have confirmation from him that he is actually in the negotiations with the Ukrainian side and with Russian side to actually start creating this security zone, demilitarized zone in that area. Again, Ukrainian government confirmed once again that they are absolutely supporting this idea and actually encourage this idea.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said on Monday that Russian President Vladimir Putin is aware of everything that's happening during the so-called special military operation in Ukraine, but wouldn't comment on the Ukrainian counteroffensive, and that Russia's special military operation is ongoing. And he also said that it will continue until it reaches all of its goals. In its latest assessment, the Institute for the Study of War writes, quote, Ukrainian forces have inflicted a major operational defeat on Russia, recapturing almost all of the Kharkiv Oblast in a rapid counteroffensive, end quote. For further analysis, I caught up with Craig Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia, over Skype, and asked him what his biggest takeaway from the weekend was.
It seems to be just a complete failure of logistics, strategy, tactics on the Russian side. Everything is just falling apart. Their lines are collapsing. Troops are leaving, running behind, and leaving all of their ammunition, leaving vehicles, leaving weapons. That's just astonishing to me that it's such a disorganized kind of retreat. I mean, Russia can use their propaganda and say that they're, you know, retrenching elsewhere and trying to solidify their forces further east and further south. But it's a disorganized retreat, and they're losing lots of numbers, but leaving all of their equipment to the Ukrainians.
You mentioned that perhaps Russia is going to characterize this as a regrouping, a retrenching, and that is something that they have put out before, similar to what they said was occurring when they weren't able to take Kyiv. But looking at what's happening based on satellite imagery and what's being reported from the Ukrainians and what is being reported by Russian sources, is this a regrouping?
I don't think so. It's just disorganized retreat. I think we see a lot of factors coming in here. The Russian military just understands it can't compete right now. They were completely taken by surprise for the southeastern advance by Ukraine, and they just left en masse. I mean, whole battalions just retreating completely. We also see some other things happening where there's much more opposition within the military. There's much more to Russia being in Ukraine. There's much more opposition by the ethnic enclaves, the different ethnic regionalities in Russia are starting to realize that most of their ethnic kin are the ones fighting and dying. So they're starting to pull back, starting to issue comments against President Putin. For instance, Ramzan Kadyrov even started, the president of Chechnya recently started to criticize the retreat, criticize what's going on, which shows that there's some kind of massive communication failure from President Putin to the rest of his forces. It's just disorganized chaos right now.
So what contributed to the disorganization? Because over the past 6 months, Russia had been making steady progress across several fronts.
Several key factors seem to be here. I think the intelligence apparatus from allied nations or those wanting to support Ukraine finally got everything on the ground the way they needed to, combined with more of the ammunition, more of the material coming from the West, especially from the United States, matching in kind with the intelligence sharing that the United States and NATO members are having with Ukraine, on top of the unexpected direction and some of the operational pushes by Ukraine, caught Russia off guard on where they were experiencing that. So you combine all that, it was just the perfect tactical and strategic decision by Ukraine to do what they did. And what that caused was what we would call an operational stalemate for the past couple of months, where it was really an artillery war, just overwhelmingly and pretty convincingly quickly shifted to the Ukrainian side and left Russia's forces just not sure of what to do. They're still losing general officers. They have no enlisted officer class. So when something like that starts to happen, there's no decentralized command on the Russian side. Their leaders start running, start panicking. So does everybody else.
Craig, in your estimation, how big a role has the support from the United States and other international partners played in Ukraine's success during its counteroffensive?
The role can't be underestimated. Without the weapons, without the intelligence, without the training on the weapons and the collaboration on the intelligence, this would not be happening. Russia has far superior numbers. They have far superior ammunition, maybe not the type of heightened ammunition and supplies that the West is now providing Ukraine, but just sheer numbers, they would be able to grind out an artillery war, for instance, for years to come if it wasn't for what the United States and NATO allies are supplying to Ukraine. So this, the reason Ukraine is able to use this counteroffensive as a victorious method to gain back, I think, something like 1,500 square miles just yesterday in their counteroffensive, it is directly due to the weapons they now have that they have been requesting, on top of the fighting mentality, morale, and fighting maneuvers of their troops. So it's not just the weapons from the West. It's their morale is extremely high. Their troops are being well-trained and ready to get after it in against Russia to take back their territory.
So what do you see as a key challenge facing Russia now?
What are their goals now? Are they still trying to keep just those main east regions in Luhansk and Donetsk? Are they going to try to solidify in the south towards Crimea? Because there's some idea and there's some operational planning that you can tell from satellites that maybe Kyiv is going to try to go after Crimea now and take that back, which would be quite interesting, of course, because Russia has held that since 2014. I think what we need to be cautious of right now is when President Putin feels that he's pushed against the wall, he tends to strike back in erratic and chaotic ways. And I think we see a little of that mentality last evening in Ukraine, when we saw some attacks on electrical plants, on some industry plants. So I would suspect that the further Putin feels like he's about to lose or get pushed into a negotiation corner where he has to capitulate to some of Ukrainian terms, the more he's probably going to attack critical infrastructure, increase the cyber attacks, not just against Ukraine, but against Western allies of Ukraine, NATO and the United States in particular, but look for his forces to also conduct more human rights atrocities as they're retreating, as they're leaving different towns. This is the way Russia has done things in the past, especially in Georgia, in Syria, and in Chechnya. And I think we can expect that more from Putin. And just one more thing, we are starting to see many more public officials in Russia condemning President Putin right now.
And challenges you see for Ukraine?
More arms, More supplies, making sure that they can keep their critical infrastructure connected, make sure that, you know, winter's approaching very quickly in Ukraine. So they have to have their food logistics and supplies ready. They have to have their electrical grids ready. Their everything connected to the internet in Ukraine has to be ready. They need more weapons, more training, especially more training on what's to come. Probably some bogged down fighting in the next few months as some of the swamps and waters freeze over. What is that going to look like? Depending on Russia, what they do. We do hear reports today that Russia is recruiting from their extreme far east, which is much more acclimated to frozen weather climatic situations. So that could give us a hint of what President Putin is thinking, that he's going to drag this out further into the winter. So that's something that Ukraine needs to be prepared for and expected as well, as what to do in this case of a more traditional, conventional fighting going on during the winter months.
Craig Albert is a full professor at Augusta University in Georgia. We're speaking over Skype, where he's also the director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies. Craig, thank you very much for your insight today.
Thank you.
For additional updates throughout the day, visit our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. A report presented at the opening of the 51st session of the UN Human Rights Council paints an alarming picture of growing abuse and violence in all regions of the world, with a few rays of hope for a peaceful resolution. Lisa Schlein has the details.
Acting High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif highlighted the growing desperation of millions of people trapped in a never-ending cycle of human rights violations, violence, and political instability in dozens of countries around the world. She addressed the worsening situation in numerous countries in Africa, including Burkina Faso, Burundi, the Central African Republic, and Mali. She offered a rare glimmer of hope regarding the nearly two-year-old conflict in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province.
Following the recent resumption of hostilities in northern Ethiopia, I am encouraged by the announcement yesterday by authorities in Tigray of their readiness to abide by an immediate cessation of hostilities and to participate in a robust peace process under the auspices of the African Union. I urge the parties to take immediate steps to end the violence once and for all, and to opt for constructive and genuine dialogue.
She dwelled at length on the unbearable levels of violence and human rights abuses by heavily armed gangs in Haiti. She called on the international community to help contain the scourge of violence in that country. However, she made only passing reference to China's incarceration of more than a million Uyghur and other Muslim minorities in so-called vocational centers. This is despite growing demands by human rights activists for a special debate on this issue at the Council.
On 31 August, my office published its assessment of human rights concerns in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China with recommendations to the government and other stakeholders.
Acting High Commissioner Al-Nashif was more robust in her criticism of Russia's actions aimed at quelling domestic opposition to its war in Ukraine.
In the Russian Federation, the intimidation, restrictive measures, and sanctions against people voicing opposition to the war in Ukraine undermine the exercise of constitutionally guaranteed fundamental freedoms. Pressure against journalists, blocking of internet resources, and other forms of censorship are incompatible with media pluralism and violate the right to access of information.
Al-Nashif said the war in Ukraine continues and the suffering of the civilian population continues. She noted the serious socioeconomic consequences of the war also persist. This, she said, has resulted in severe fuel shortages and threats to food security in some of the world's poorest countries. She added the devastation caused by the war in Ukraine will be discussed later in the session. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China's leader Xi Jinping will leave China for the first time in more than 2 years for a trip this week to Central Asia, where he'll also meet Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson is up next.
For the first time in more than 2 years, China's President Xi Jinping is planning to travel overseas. Xi is expected to go to Central Asia this week, where he will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin. It will be the first time he has left China since the start of the global health crisis and shows just how confident he is about his grip on power. It also underlines just how perilous the global situation has become. Xi's trip to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan comes against the backdrop of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There appears to be no sign that Xi is ready to drop his support for Putin in Russia's most serious confrontation with the West since the height of the Cold War. Also playing on people's minds is the crisis over Taiwan and a stuttering global economy. China has yet to confirm Xi's travel plans, but last week, during a meeting with China's top legislator, Putin said he planned to hold talks with Xi in Uzbekistan. The two leaders are expected to attend a summit there of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which kicks off on Thursday. The meeting will give Xi an opportunity to underscore his clout, while Putin can demonstrate Russia's tilt towards Asia. The West, no doubt, will be watching on closely.
Flora Bradley Watson reports for Reuters News. And finally, a group of friends in California has organized food festivals to help Ukraine. Volunteers cook Ukrainian food and teach everyone willing to learn. VOA's Russia service visited a festival in this report that's narrated by Anna Rice.
Volunteers Christina and Yulia spent the previous night cooking for this food festival.
40 liters of cold borscht, 50 liters of hot borscht, two types of vegan borscht.
The volunteers organized this food festival in Los Angeles, California, to raise more money for Ukraine. They have already sent tens of thousands of dollars to the country and a powerful message to young people.
We wanted to let this new generation feel that the world is not all evil, that there are people who want to help.
These volunteers say they couldn't just stand back. Many have friends or relatives in Ukraine.
We are just a group of 14 friends. This is the third fundraiser we organized to help the people of Ukraine. Life has changed completely. There was life before the war, and now there is life after the war.
Halina Bondar is a volunteer who is constantly in touch with Ukrainian refugees. She helps families get to the U.S. from Ukraine, thanks to the White House program Uniting for Ukraine.
Many people are looking for help. They cannot enter the U.S. if there is no one here who can act as a sponsor. I've acted as a sponsor for five people, women, women with children.
Alena Tokareva is herself a refugee from Ukraine. She says the weight of the war is especially heavy when she calls home.
Very often, at the end of our conversation, my friends and relatives start crying and say, "We will see each other again, right?" And I say optimistically, "Are you crazy? Of course we will. We have so many plans." But when I hang up, I start crying because I really don't know if we are going to see each other again.
While many volunteers are Ukrainian, many others are not.
Now I'm very open-minded to kind of the plights that everyone's going through, maybe even putting a little more of my time, or as much of my time as I can, to supporting other people who really need it.
Volunteers say the goal of the festivals is not just to raise money for Ukraine, but also to keep the spotlight on Russia's ongoing war against it. For VOA Russian, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team here at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.